Hi, this is Barry, and welcome to the Simplicity Zen podcast. If you are watching this on YouTube, as opposed to the networks for podcasts, if you could take a moment and like the video and subscribe and then hit the little alert button, these are all signals that help to motivate the YouTube algorithm to share this to more people. I've noticed in the videos that where people do this, viewership does actually go up. So I appreciate it when people do this. If you are watching on the podcast networks, you can go to our website, which is simplicityzen.com, and you can sign up for the mailing list there. Today, my guest is the Reverend Jay Rinsen Weik Roshi. He's the abbot of the Buddhist Temple of Toledo. He received Dharma transmission from Reverend James Myung Ford Roshi in 2014. He began his practice in 1987 with John Dido Lori Roshi at the Zen Mountain Monastery in New York and received Jukai from him in 1998. He later studied with Dido Lori's Dharma heir, Bonnie Myotai Trace. And he's also a professional jazz musician and a Aikido teacher. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely, Barry. Thanks for having me. And I have to say before we launch, I really appreciate the effort that you're making. I've been following what you've been doing for a while, and that's great that you're taking this up.
I appreciate it. A couple questions. One, I'm curious, when you guys named your, you guys seem a little rare, when you named your practice center, you didn't put Zen in the name. You just called it the Buddhist Center of Toledo, as opposed to the Zen Center of Toledo or something. Could you describe that a little bit?
Yeah. It's not even the Buddhist Center. It's the Buddhist Temple of Toledo. You know, we've gone through lots of iterations here in Toledo. We started off, in 2001 is when I moved back to Toledo. I lived in Boston for about 15 years where I went to school, right? And that's where I started practicing. We started off as a affiliate of Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen, now Roshi, came out here and did a weekend for us. And we were a sitting group, you know, and then eventually we became the Toledo Zen Center. We used that name. It seemed a better term. Mm-hmm. But really what happened is when I connected with Myoen Ford, James Ford Roshi, my transmitting teacher, and a path to ordination opened. A limiting factor for us was that the initial place of my training conflates ordination and monastic life, as is that's their choice to do, and that's fine, you know, but that precluded myself. Once ordination became possible without necessarily meaning a monastic life, well, now priesthood is something that I've always had a very strong resonance with, even in the Catholic tradition that I was raised in. I have a strong affinity for that role and that archetype and stuff. And so once that became possible and that connected, then Zen Center, it just felt too secular and too, I don't know, it didn't fit right. Suddenly, we're trying to have a temple here, you know. And, we do legally, it is the Zen Buddhist Temple of Toledo. It's Daishin Kokuji, which means Great Heartland Zen Buddhist Temple of Toledo, which is too much to say, you know. We shortened it to just Buddhist Temple of Toledo, partly because it's easier to say, I think, but also partly because we also have a transmission from the Gelupa lineage of Tibetan practice. When we moved back here, how to tell the tale. It's kind of an interesting one. There's this group.
Yeah, we can get to it when we get to it. Kind of chronologically, sorry to interrupt you. I just don't want you to steal my thunder. And from what I've seen, kind of watching from afar, I mean, it seems a pretty thriving, dynamic community with very importantly a lot of young people showing up.
Yeah, I mean, if you came to a typical Sunday service. Rough cut, 80 people, maybe 50, somewhere in that number, and probably 70%, 60% of them or so are under 40. It's a lot of young families with kids. It's not just all college students. We certainly have a lot of college kids, but it's I mean, there's elders to be sure. We have a diverse age range, but it's primarily folks that look at me and think I'm old.
In fact, I was talking to someone today that it's kind of weird that I'm 50. In a lot of Zen groups, I'm one of the young people.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. For sure. I'm 50. What am I, 4 today? Mm-hmm. And at this moment. And yeah, we're youngins. We're youngins. You know, I mean, it's there's a swell of boomer folk. And that's fine. You know, I mean, that's you know, bows to them, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But at the same time, I would like to see this tradition flourish and grow in this country.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it's good for people. So do you guys have any residential aspects of the temple, or is it primarily?
Yeah, we do. The way it works is we're, you know, it's emergent, you know, we started off as a Wednesday night people. We're Wednesday night people. You know, we had a Wednesday night sitting, and that's kind of what we did. And then eventually we started being able to do retreats. So, you know, once a season or so, we do a day or two, something like that. And then eventually we got to having a Sunday service kind of thing happen. See, and now that's a whole other group of folks. And then we started having a Dharma school for kids. Parents with kids, right? And then we started having longer duration retreats, and all these things gradually have kind of come online kind of at the appropriate pace, I would say. You know, you can't do all this stuff kind of at once, you know, so over decades, really. Mm-hmm. And right now, one of the emergent features is a residential training program.
Do you guys have bunks or rooms? Oh, or?
Yeah, we've got, like, we do a session every month. You know, we're very session focused. You know, we've got sort of the family Sunday sutra service kind of thing happening. We've got morning sitting every day, evening at least once a week, Wednesday night. But the big gun really is the session every month. Mm-hmm. And that's a couple of days to a week, depending, right? So we've got bunks for that, and people come from all over the place. You know, if you find a teacher you resonate with, it's worth the pain in the ass to get to them. Mm-hmm. You know, and so people travel to get here, and there's a lot of local folks. But actually having people permanently in residence requires a different kind of housing facility, which we've acquired, and we're working through and screening candidates and figuring out what kind of mistakes we can make in that venture.
Do you do Koan training online, or is it in person largely?
Well,
I mean, as the teacher, provide Koan training.
Yeah, yeah. No, I get you. I mean, before the pandemic, my answer would be a hard no. No way, because most of the communication and the exchange that happens is kinesthetic, you know, it's energetic, it's in the flesh kind of stuff, and pixelated experience is too diluted. However, the pandemic hit, right? And like everybody else, we pivoted. You know, we had a monthly Zoom going for distance members, which was, so we already had some traction with this. But in the pandemic, I spent the whole time on this little machine here pixelating and trying to help people. And I made Doksan available that way. We did retreats that way and all the kind of stuff that a lot of people ended up trying to figure out how to do, you know. Mm-hmm. What I would say today, though, is that for somebody in their first decade of training, I don't feel that online Doksan, actually, I should rephrase. Once you really get into actual koan study, the first 10 years or so of koan study, I don't think is best served with a pixelated experience. I feel that the in-person container communicates so much. However, once someone is past a certain stage of training, I think that that's possibly less important. Mm-hmm. You know, but since the pandemic is done, and my ass is in that Doksan room all the time, and I'm here, man. I'm doing it, you know, and then people are coming here to train. That's the preferred, for sure.
I would agree absolutely that in person is better. There's just an energetic transfer that's stronger. Though, I mean, since you asked for my opinion, I'll tell you. I'm just joking. But, but I mean, seriously, I think working with a teacher you vibe with and have a good kind of karmic connection with, I think is more important than the in person. So that's one thing I really like about Zoom, is it really allows the puzzle pieces of teachers and students to connect.
Sure.
And, yeah. And I think it's worth, in my opinion, and I know a lot of people disagree, but I think that makes up for the limitations of the medium. That's just my opinion.
Well, you know, it's a fair point of view to hold, you know, and I think actually the answer won't be clear till probably 50 years past our mortality, because the question is, if that replicates and replicates and replicates, what does it look like then? Right. So like, you know, like right now, like, for example, in jazz music education, okay, there's a lot of online stuff. There's a lot of play alongs and there's apps for that now, and you can do a lot of stuff, and it's completely different from actually learning to play on the stage with guys who can just kick your ass, right? Mm-hmm. And being up on there and playing and getting pushed and being in front of a live audience. Okay. Now there's drawbacks to that because it's scary as all hell, but there's a lot of advantage to it because you actually learn in the space and there's a feeling that has to happen, and an app can't do that. Okay. Now, the app has a lot of value, particularly if you've passed that threshold, right? But what's interesting is there's a parallel thing happening, I think, in education in all forms, or at least those I'm in touch with, that the young cats who are connecting primarily through the app, and they've never actually been on the stand with heavies, they really have a very hard time because it's completely different. So the way my point of view at this time is that the basics are too advanced for beginners, and you have to really be in person to feel that direct connection. Mm-hmm. In any of the arts I'm involved in, Aikido, jazz music, or Zen, these are all arts, I would say. They're full contact human arts. And who knows? We don't know. I'm biased. Because I'm older than Google. So, you know, I mean, I started learning how to play before the internet was a thing, really. Mm-hmm. So I understand my perspective is skewed a little bit. But the concern I have is, what does it look like generations down the line, you know? Mm-hmm. And who knows? I'll never be able to know that.
Did you ever by chance see the Grateful Dead, the band, the Grateful Dead Live?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like that. I mean, I think that really plays into what you're saying. I mean, there's just nothing like being there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was like, that was the core experience. Mm-hmm. And the accordions and all that was just.
Yeah.
But I mean, unless you see the Grateful Dead, unless you saw the Grateful Dead live, you may love the Grateful Dead. You may have wonderful experiences listening to them. But unless you were there live in the room with them or in the venue with them, there's an element of that experience that is just, you'll never know. It's just one of the most unique phenomena I've ever experienced in my life. And
yeah. Well, I think that's to the point, isn't it? I mean, this mind-to-mind transmission, this is a very human thing, right? Mm-hmm. And like, there's something to being in the kinesthetic presence, to say it baldly, of an awakened person, particularly if you're in a formal setting that's designed to help you, right? It's not going to make so much a difference if you're hanging out in the coffee shop. Well, maybe. But if you're in that formal setting, my opinion, everything is designed to set you up so that you can feel the feels and you can taste the taste and you can encounter the thing. And, you know, goddammit, at some moments you should be pushing up against something that's a little bit scary, your own edges of suffering and the places that you're hooked. You know, if it doesn't push you, if it doesn't make you the hair go up a little bit on the back of your neck at times, mm-hmm. then I would say, what are we doing? It's not just a relaxation trip, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, I've had the experience of, you know, and I'm sure many of us have, but you know, the dawn has not yet crested. The wake up bell is happening. Everybody's stumbling around silently, getting their shit together. And you get into this, you know, and the thing coming in, the Roshi comes in, oh shit, sit straight, you know, and then the opening rituals go on, and incense and whisks and robes, From a certain point of view, all that stuff is so much horseshit. From another point of view, it's critical and vital because it actually, it catalyzes an experience. And that experience has transformational and integrational value that once you've had, then you don't need it anymore to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't need session anymore myself. I do it for others at this point, you know. But that's because 30 years later, mm-hmm. you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of days in it. So it's an open question, you know. I mean, some of my most transformational or impactful experiences were nonverbal, kinesthetic, being deeply in the presence of a presence that was present to me back. I don't know, something like this. There's a palpable feeling. And frankly, something about Zoom is like, you know, you don't know what's on the outsides of this little box here. Is my dirty underwear over there? Is
you need to leave. I'm joking.
You know, and it's very easy for the ego to put up a nice, hey, how are you? Good to see you. What's happening? Hey, here we are. And then, cook, you shut it off. Whew, yeah, okay. You can't do that at retreat. Your ass is on the firing line the whole time. And that's what you want. And that's what you need. And I don't know another way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Two more questions about your current state before we dive into the history. Do you guys mm-hmm. do any formal ongos or practice periods?
Yeah, we do a... We do a fall ongo and we do a spring ongo like that. Yeah. And then we have a summer practice period and a winter practice period.
How do you differentiate an ongo from a practice period?
Oh, you know, one of the main things is that the ongos tend to have a theme. Mm-hmm. And we hope to have a shuso every ongo. You know, we're just kind of getting there. We've had a couple. We just had one shuso go through this last spring ongo. And so when you've got a head disciple, a head of practice that everybody's looking at and modeling, it opens with their way-seeking mind talk. They're very visible throughout the ongo. They do a Dharma combat at the end with a koan. They don't know what's coming. That gives it a very specific rigor. You know, the schedule beefs up a bit. The sessions get a little more intense like that, you know. Mm-hmm. Summertime. Honestly, it's not much of a break. We have so much going on. You know, we have one big annual Jikai empowerment that happens. So rather than do this little piecemeal all the time, I form cohorts. So that tends to really rush up as Ango is closing. And then this Jikai process is going on. So for those folks, the summer is more of an intense experience than the Ango was probably. Mm-hmm. You know,
and that kind of segues to my next question is, so priest training clearly was important to you. Are your quote unquote senior disciples, are they on the priest track or are they priests now? Or would you fully authorize someone who's a lay person? Like, I'm curious what kind of the career path under your, you know, yeah. Is it necessitated? Does it have to be priest? Can it be lay? Like, those type of questions.
Yeah, let's chat about it. I mean, it's that's a rich question because there's a lot of varying and good answers to that question. You know, I got to preface by saying my answer is not the only one for sure. You know, but what I feel is that the teacher has to transmit in a way that feels authentic to the teacher and to the disciple, right? Obviously, that thing has to be there, right? So the way it is here is that someone can be a shuso without ordaining. So what they do is they become a member, and then if they feel so resonant, they can receive Jikai. And then once they've received Jikai and taken the precepts, we view that as the Mahayana Buddhist part, okay? If they want to get into the Zen part and be a formal Zen student, then we formalize the Shokan student-teacher relationship. At that point, that person's now a Sesshin student, okay? So there's plenty of people in our Sangha that have a Roksu and no robe, and they're perfect Bodhisattva practitioners, or as perfect as they can be, right?
Is Jukai a prerequisite to Shokan?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's, that's a conscious decision that we've made, because if we feel like, and that's contrary to what my first place of training did. But I feel like taking refuge, like really receiving the initiation and the empowerment of refuge in the Triple Gem, that's front gate stuff to me. That's not a someday maybe we'll get there thing. That in my view should be, if someone feels it, that's more of an entryway thing, along with the pure precepts in the grave. And once they've got that moral and ethical base, and in the first stage of training, it's really about moral and ethical base, if they choose the Buddhist path, and equanimity, concentration practice, samadhi stuff. Okay. Now, if they're going to move into wisdom training and confront Mu and get into Kensho and all this stuff, I won't do that with somebody that doesn't have a very firm and solid moral and ethical base as a prerequisite to that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to just jump right into wisdom stuff with somebody if that moral and ethical stuff isn't locked on and on point. Now, there's other ways to do that besides taking the 16 Bodhisattva precepts, granted. You know, I've got a Roman Catholic sister who's lived a vowed religious life beautifully and impeccably for decades and decades and decades. This lady is, she's fine. She's got a moral and ethical base. We can go into koan study, no worries. Now, she did Shokan. She's got the gray Shokan robe. But she didn't take the precepts. So there is no one size only thing here. But in general, I want the moral and ethical stuff online first. Equanimity is there, moral and ethical, at least the baseline of it. Then if they start feeling attracted to Sesshin, then they start doing some Sesshin. They start exploring what that's like. And then they take a year of formation and to see what being a Shokan student is like. There's a covenant that we have that's very clearly spelled out that really defines the student-teacher relationship, not just with myself, but with Doan Sensei. We work together, hand in glove, you know. And so there's a lot of formation. There's a lot of care. Frankly, Sesshin is not right for everybody, as fond as I am of it. There's some people for whom it's just not a good idea. And I want to find that out in advance.
Like people's trauma, do you mean? Or what?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've learned a lot. I mean, we as a collective, I hope.
You know, or excessive trauma. Everyone's had some trauma, but.
Yeah.
I mean,
So anyway, if they do the Shokan process, if they feel resonance with Sesshin and really taking Doan Sensei and myself on as their primary spiritual guides, that's fine. And then if they move through, you know, somewhere in the gateless gate, about halfway through or so, plus having a kind of connection that's palpable, there's a whole a list, a host of things. Then we'll ask them to be shuso, tell them really at that stage. And that has nothing to do with ordination. Ordination is separate from that. You know, and I wouldn't ordain somebody that isn't a Shokan student, and they need to have been a Shokan student pretty solidly for a while.
And Shokan's a private ceremony between you and the student, right?
No, again, I think of everything in terms of cohorts. So the way we do it is we have a, there's a session formation, or I'm sorry, a Shokan formal student formation period. It's a year. They'll state their intention to do so. They'll go before what's called the Guardian Council. Why would you want to do something as foolish as this? You know, are you sure? You know, I mean, this kind of stuff, right? And really get into the why of it. If it makes sense, then
we influenced by this. Daido did something similar, right? Were you influenced by that? Yeah,
very similar. Mm-hmm. I was rejected by the Guardian Council first.
and so your students, until they've done Shokan, they don't get Mu. Is that correct?
Generally, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because what Shokan means is they're doing Sesshin. And for me, koan study is a religious practice that has a native environment and an ecosystem within which it functions. Mm-hmm. And that ecosystem is Sesshin. Okay. So if someone's like not doing session, to me, I would think having them do koan study is just going to be highly problematic. Mm-hmm. There's always exceptions. I'm the first guy to say that. But in general, somebody needs a palpable samadhi and equanimity that's fortified by a certain amount of days of serious sitting in person with the smells and the bells and all that stuff, so that it can be communicated and be clear, right? And verifiably so. And then once that's in place, then if they've got that equanimity base and they've got the moral and ethical guidelines on point, then I'll be willing to go in there with them. Because it was told to me decades ago that, all you need is Kensho. If you get Kensho, all will be well. All will be clear. All will flow from this. And you know what? Not so.
Who said this?
Oh, you know, do I have to mention? I mean, you know, you heard of the Three Pillars of Zen?
Yes.
That book, yeah. There was a breakaway teacher from that lineage named Richard Clark, who was not authorized by Philip Kaplow.
Right.
But he was an important influence for Doan. And she spent 10 years training with him, and he was a breakaway from Philip, who broke away from his, that whole thing. But he was one of these Kensho only guys.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not sufficient. It's really not.
It could be damaging, I think, even.
What, say again?
I think it can be damaging in isolation.
Yeah. I mean, the fact is, if you don't see, that's the Buddhist part, right? To me, the Mahayana Buddhist framework gives you a context to make meaning of and to integrate and to comprehend and word and deal with this Kensho, which is beyond all that shit. But if you don't have some kind of a cognitive basis, I'm not convinced that it's always a good thing. See? And even if... Yeah?
Oh, sorry. I'm convinced a lot of the attributes that people say when they describe a Kensho experience, I think a lot of the attributes that they're describing are actually not the Kensho, but rather the dualistic reverberations that actually come from that shift. And so it's kind of dualistic anyway. And so you kind of need that dualistic framework, I think, to make sense of it. Personally, I think.
There's nothing wrong with dualism. It's just that it's partial. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's necessary, but it's not sufficient, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with if you just somehow got stuck in the absolute, you're screwed, man. You're not going to get lunch to happen. It's not good, you know, but it's necessary. See, what's required, in my view, and the lineage as I understand it, is that nobody generally needs training in dualistic mind. We kind of come in with that. It's the non-dual mind, but that's having that open is just the initial thing. The majority of Zen training has to do with integrating and living out of, in a world of this and that, yes and no, up and down, the beyond yin and yang. See, how do you get that to function like for real, right? Mm-hmm. And so again, to me, as a teacher, I don't feel that I would know well enough what's really going on in a student's life if we've got a 20-minute Zoom hello once a week.
Mm-hmm.
I just have seen too many people who are too good at fooling themselves and me in ways that you can't do at retreat. See, mm-hmm. I should say not as easily. I mean, you can fool people there too, I suppose, you know, mm-hmm. But again, I don't want to say that online work can't help. It certainly can. And it certainly does. And there are teachers who have more affinity for it than I do, obviously, you know. But I would still say they're probably best for people that are already pretty far along when they start.
Mm-hmm.
You see, like, again, a really advanced jazz musician can grab the app and get a lot of benefit from it. That junior who's trying to figure out how to play, it's not the right thing for him to be doing with his time.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. So I want to transition to the kind of the narrative history.
Well, you know, let's clean up, if we could, that question about ordination and transmission.
Oh, yes, please.
We never really got there.
Oh, you're right. I'm so glad you're sometimes.
Yeah, it's relevant, you know, because...
No, I want to hear it. I forgot I even asked. I want to hear the answer.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about this is that, you know, what is priesthood, right? The great question, you know, why is it relevant? Who gives a shit about it? Why does it matter anymore? You know, we're not sacrificing things. What the hell? What's going on here, right? So my view, our view on this is that it is not conflated with a monastic life, okay? Mm-hmm. Someone who's ordained here at the Buddhist Temple of Toledo is somebody who has a firm grounding in everything we've talked about so far, equanimity, compassion, wisdom has to be coming online. Doesn't have to be completed, but it has to be looking good in that area, okay? Mm-hmm. And then really it has to do with service to the Sangha. And that can look lots of different ways. You know, a teaching I received from my transmitting teacher, Myohan Roshi, was that a priest should hold the Sangha and their vocation as important as one of their kids. Mm-hmm. So it's not like the only thing in a person's life, but it's a big deal, you know, like, I'm always thinking about my daughter and how to help her and what can go on. And the Sangha is kind of right there kind of with it, you know, and it's not more important than my marriage. It's not more important than my own Dharma practice as an individual, but it's way up there, right? So if someone has that priestly service to the Sangha thing and it starts to actually show up, like they start functioning that way long before they're ordained, see? And then it's like, then the conversations start happening, if that makes sense.
How do you identify this? This is someone just taking on roles like ringing the bells and setting up
It's not just that. And I want to emphasize, it's not like it's better for people to get ordained and people who don't ordain are lesser. That's not the case. Mm-hmm. It's not the case. There are very, very, very solidly awakened folks for whom ordination is simply not authentic, and it shouldn't be. And that's fine. You know what I mean? But what it has to do with, in my view, is that a priest is someone who, like, you know, if my daughter is in trouble at 3 a.m., I'm taking the fucking call and I'm going to get up and I'm going to deal. Okay. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. One of my university students, hey, I'm not your dad. You know, we'll talk at your lesson time. You know what I'm saying? Or I'll refer you to counseling or something like that. To me, a priest is someone who, when you get that 3 a.m. call, you're taking the call.
In a Dharma context.
Mm hmm. Yeah, it's a metaphor, it's a simile, you know, but I mean it speaks to a quality that I feel is actually what priestly practice is about. In addition to the robes and the forms, the magical aspects, the liturgical aspects, which are central, obviously, holding the forms down and all that. But frankly, there's a lot of very, very deep Shokan students who hold the forms impeccably here. That's not the defining thing.
Mm-hmm. So kind of continuing this thread, what's the relationship between ordination and Dharma transmission for you?
Well, for me, it means that someone would be able to take the Dharma as I've understood it and use that as a basis for whatever they want to do.
But more specifically, is ordination a prerequisite to Dharma transmission in the way you're teaching?
Well, I can't imagine somebody filling the role that Doan Sensei and I fill here without being ordained. It wouldn't work. We're a full-on family temple. We have all the seasonal ceremonies and we do all the religious rites and rituals and stuff. So if somebody was a very, very sharp, clear-eyed lay person and they were near to the end of their koan training, let's say, or completed it even, and they wanted transmission, my question would be, well, why wouldn't you want to ordain? What is it that you think ordination is that you don't want? Because actually, if ordination is understood as a firm commitment to the Sangha, if you're not willing to make that firm commitment to the Sangha, you're not a teacher, in my opinion, right? If I'm going to say, yes, I will be here and teach, that means I'm taking the call. That means I'm stable, I'm present, I'm reliable. Okay. And that's what priesthood means to me. So if you're saying, oh, no, I don't want to ordain, it's like, well, what, aren't you committed? And if you're not committed, I'm not transmitting to you.
Well, so just to be devil's advocate, what if, let's say somebody is a Catholic, you know, let's say someone's a Catholic priest and they're ordained as a Catholic priest.
I consider that.
Okay.
Because see, again, like I keep saying, there's not like one hard and fast, but like someone like that, like I studied also with Father Kevin Hunt for a while, the Trappist Cistercian who received from Robert Jinsen Kennedy SJ, who received from Bernie Glassman. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and he was a very pivotal teacher for me in a very important way. Right. Because my Catholic upbringing and my resonance with monastic life and all this stuff needed some resolving. And so here's a guy who's a Roman Catholic priest and a Trappist monastic of decades of depth, also a Zen master. Sure. And I went and studied with him, and I'm ever grateful to him. He really helped resolve the lingering lack of clarity I had around that whole trip. See? Mm-hmm. So there it is. Now, if I had someone like that, that's an extreme circumstance. But if barring that, you know, Father Kevin, he's committed to his students. He's there. He's there for them. He's not a tumbleweed. He's rooted, right? So, that's how I think about it.
How about somebody who's skeptical of the cosmological aspects of Buddhism? Is that a barrier to ordination or transmission for you?
No. I mean, because I don't need to have ontological or metaphysical truth claims be signed on to. That's not what this is about. You know, I think someone needs to be fluent in them and understand them. You can take them quite seriously without taking them literally. You know, that's a thing. There's a wisdom. There's a heart of wisdom in there that's real. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that heart of wisdom has got to be understood, unlocked, and integrated. Now, whether you take the stuff literally, metaphorically, in a sense, I don't think matters. What matters is that you take in the nutrition and digest it. See? So if someone has the view, and I say this to my students all the time, if you have the view that rebirth is obvious, how could you not see it? And you can commune with this and it makes sense to you and you have feelings about it that affirm it or whatever. Okay. Then whatever happens post-mortem depends on your karma in this life. So what it comes down to is what you do in this moment. Uh-huh. Fine. Now, if you're someone who ontologically doesn't believe in that or metaphysically doesn't agree to it, and when you die, there's not even a dial tone, it's just nothingness. Then all you have is this moment. So what matters is this moment. Okay. So compassion, equanimity, wisdom, upaya, creatively engaging in the world doesn't hinge on some set of unprovable truth claims, in my opinion. However, the tradition comes through thousands of years, centuries of culture, not to be just dismissed with a huff and a flared nostril. I mean, I think that's arrogant, right? So the mind of not knowing, the mind of being open, keeping a beginner's mind, as we hear in the tradition a lot, and relentlessly engaging in what's true in this moment. That's the ticket.
Great. So you grew up in New York? Is that right?
No.
No.
I grew up here in the Shire of Toledo, Ohio.
Okay.
So
this is your home base, and you mentioned you grew up Catholic, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So were you pretty religious?
My family was very my mom still is very devoted, as is my dad. They have a strong Marian devotion as a couple. You know, but back in the day, man, you know, like everybody on the block was Catholic. I went to a Catholic grade school. We had one strange person that was Lutheran, whatever that is. I mean, it was a very monocultural experience here. Classic suburban thing. My uncle was the priest, you know. So it was just kind of around, right? So I started doing altar boy stuff, we called it at the time, you know. But something about the ritual and the liturgical that liturgical expression actually spoke to me in a very real way. Particularly, I remember there was a guy named Father Brennan. This is going way back, and I'm a kid, you know, I'm whatever, sixth grade or whatever you are when you start doing this stuff. But we used to take the Eucharist, the communion, to the old folks' homes. And none of the other altar boys wanted to do that because it was gross and it was not fun and it smelled bad or whatever. But I'm like, I'll go, you know. So I would help Father. He was old at that time, and I carry this stuff, and we wear our little cassocks and the thing. But see, putting on that robe and putting on the vestments, and I saw a lot of last rites and the little thing with the cream and the oil or whatever the fuck it is and all that stuff, it actually helped. Like, I saw it right in front of me. And of course, as a young person, I thought it was actually the thing. And now I see it a little differently. You know, it's not that this one tradition owns the truth. There's an impeccably human experience that's happening there. Mm-hmm. It shows up all kinds of ways. It shows up as long as humans have been humans. See, and I think what the Buddha did and what Zen masters have done is take that basic human impulse and not wrap it in us versus them, the righteous versus the idiots or something, but use those things as upaya to awakening. So rituals and rites, if they're the currency you're trading in, it's just shallow, it's stupid. But if it's an upaya and it helps awakening, now that's a whole different thing, see, and it has value there. See?
Would you, looking back, did you have any experiences that at the time maybe you would have labeled like the Holy Ghost, or, you know, what maybe now might be a samadhi or even a baby Kensho or some sort of jhanic, you know, jhana experience, you know?
Well,
did you have any propensity to do it as a kid?
I know, yeah, I do, for sure. I mean, there was a time when I was very young, so young that I was small enough that when I was misbehaving and my mom needed to put me in timeout, she sat me on a chair in the dining room, which then had wall carpet because it's the 70s. And so I'm sitting in this little chair and my feet don't touch the floor. And I'm sitting there facing the wall. And so mom goes in the kitchen and she's doing book work for the carpet store because they own the carpet store. And she kind of forgot about me because I got very quiet. And I remember that goddamn wall carpet to this day. I stared at the wall carpet and I was like, okay, I'm not going to move. And I didn't move. And I just sat there. And guess what? Well, I just sunk right into what I would now identify as a pretty deep samadhi, you know, deep enough that I can still feel it when I call it up. See? And I sat there for an unknown amount of time. And it was great. And it was amazing. And I went through stuff, you know, okay. Past life, dumb luck. I don't know. I don't need to know. I know
how about, I mean, did you have any kind of experiences that you thought like, oh, this is God?
Oh, sure. As I aged and tried to see, again, it gets back to that cognitive framework thing we're talking about. See, if the cognitive framework is telling you there's an entity out there that you have to contact with and they have to contact you back in some palpable way, and there's got to be this walkie-talkie thing going, or you got to get signs, or you got to feel it in your heart, or some shit. There's got to be this, you know, and so the whole thing starts hooking around this relationship with God. And this, now you encounter the mystics, okay? You read John of the Cross, and nothing, even on the top of the mountain, nothing. That's a whole different terrain, and I didn't become aware of that until I was in high school, late high school, or really in college, when I left the Shire and went to Gondor, Boston, and I started studying in the archives, I encountered all this other side to the Catholic experience beyond what a kid in the Shire is going to hear on a Sunday. See, so there I heard about Thomas Merton.
But I, even as a kid or a teenager, you know, prior to your awareness of the mystics, I mean, did you have direct experiences of divine reality? But, you know, that you would.
Yeah, I would say that I did. If you talked to me at that age, I would have a lot of certainty around that. Mm-hmm. In an affirmative way. Yeah.
Yeah.
But see, interestingly, it always left me with more questions and a drive to the contemplative and to silence. Mm-hmm. And so what really started happening is I started investigating monastic life and the contemplative traditions, see. And like, actually, I spent a lot of time in Catholic monasteries of different kinds and different religious orders trying to find where the hell do I plug in here.
Oh, so you were considered being a monastic.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But you see, I'm also a jazz cat, and I'm a fairly good swordsman as far as it goes. And so these aspects of my life, not to mention I'm in love with my wife, or I was about to be, right? How does all of that fit somewhere, right? And that's when I met Daido. See, I went up there as an uke or an assistant to my Aikido teacher, who was a Shokan student of Daido's. Mm-hmm. And there I saw Zen, you know, I encountered it as a tradition that could actually hold the totality of me and further me and help me realize this whole thing without me needing to eclipse parts of my life and leave them bleeding in the road while I enter. Mm-hmm. You know, the main thing is the ego has to get clipped. It's not about the celibacy or not, or these things. It's the deluded I that has to be seen through. Mm-hmm. You can do that, whatever your life circumstance.
One question I typically ask people who are around my age is, what role do you think Star Wars played in your formation of your worldview it's kind of a silly question, but
no, it's not.
Star Wars made a huge, like the whole Jedi Force.
Man,
I mean, made a huge,
totally. Impression I can on remember me. Being it's 1977. I'm eight. Mm-hmm. I'm eight. Okay, I'm eight. There I am. I'm eight. I'm sitting in this theater, and the little Princess Leia ship goes by. You know, pew pew pew, and the planet. Holy shit! And this thing comes past. Right. It just keeps going. You know what I'm saying? Awe. Yeah. I mean, to me, our deep ancestors sat around the fire, right? With the stars when you could fucking see them, and smoke and sparks happening. And then the old guy hobbles up. Well, let's have a story, you know, and this kind of ooh and huddle in. It's again, this is a deeply human thing. Mm-hmm. This imaginal life. See, it's a modern tale. It has its flaws. Nonetheless, it plays those archetypal keys, you see. So the idea of the Force and the lightsaber, that's just cool. Come on, give it up. That's cool. So, yeah. So guess what? I started studying martial arts and sword, right?
Would you attribute that to Star Wars?
Well, Star Wars and Elvis.
Elvis?
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
You're going to have to elaborate on that one.
Oh, well. Elvis, you know, all things lead to Elvis. So my dad, unbeknownst to me, was a huge Elvis fan. See, but again, I think it was 77 or 78. Elvis died. I'd never heard of the guy. We're sitting there in front of the TV, you know, and the news flashes, Elvis died, and it hit my dad like a ton of bricks. And I'd never seen him respond emotionally in that way to kind of anything. At least that was my perception at the time. And so he was so moved by this that he said, come on, Jade. We got in the car. We drove down to the record store and bought a mess of 8-track tapes because that's what we had. And we had a bunch of Elvis 8-track tapes. And I was like, what's this? And he's like, this is Elvis. You got to listen to Elvis. So this was a special thing. Right. This is dad. I love dad. I love dad. Dad loves me. Dad loved Elvis. So I should love Elvis or whatever. I'm not thinking of it like that, but that's what's going on. And I start checking out the music of Elvis. And it turns out I can remember all the melodies and I can along with things and it makes sense. And guess what? Elvis played guitar. And Elvis did karate, you know, karate Elvis. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's great. So him as a person, you know, he did karate. My dad thought that was cool. So when the option came out, hey, dad, I want to do karate too, because I'm thinking Jedi and I'm thinking Elvis. And I'm also thinking, you know, if you go past life stuff, it's like it's in my cells. It just is. Came in with it. My teddy bear when I was a kid was a priest, was a martial artist, and played guitar when I'm like a kid, tiny. So these three things keep going, see? So what I think is important for in my path anyway is that I needed to find a way to experience myself authentically in the different areas of life that resonated with me. And that's what Zen allowed me to do.
Mm-hmm.
And continues to.
Yeah. Did you start Aikido when you were still in high school?
No. There was no such advanced thing. We were all clone troopers out here. We just did clone trooper stuff. It wasn't until I got to Boston that there was this Jedi art called Aikido. I heard about Taekwondo.
Or something.
Yeah. Stand up, punch and kick, kind of normal, whatever, pajama, yelling stuff. It was fine, you know, but it never really felt right to me because at heart, I'm really not a violent person. So like smacking people, I mean, you know, it's a thing, but I'm not like that. So I heard about Aikido. There was a book called Zen and the Martial Arts, and I had a black belt on the cover, and there was a bookstore here called Thackeray's, and I was real young, and my mom was a school teacher, and there was suddenly a book I'm interested in because it had a black belt on it, and it's got called Zen and the Martial Arts. It's a bunch of little Taoist teaching stories, really, is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But in there, Aikido is talked about, and it's described as this very spiritual, very evolved, otherworldly kind of art. So when I got to Boston, I remembered that, and I looked in the phone book, because that's what it was. You didn't have a phone, you had a phone book. And I looked in martial arts, and lo and behold, there was an Aikido teacher down from the place where I was in Boston. So I went and saw him, and he's still my teacher, Bill Gleason, Shion. He's amazing. And, you know, as soon as I saw it, I knew that was my jam. And he was a Zen student.
Interesting. What brought you to Boston? College?
Yeah, Berklee College of Music.
So I'm guessing you started playing guitar when you were young.
Yeah. Like around eight.
Is that, I think I've seen you videos of you playing jazz guitar. Is that still your primary instrument?
Oh yeah. I play shakuhachi, badly, you know, but I do. And, but I'm really a guitarist for sure. And that's what my professorship is. And that's what supported this whole thing. You know,
mm-hmm.
Strangely, my day gig is as jazz guitar player, but I'm really lucky. When I was here as a kid, there was no, I mean, I studied classical guitar at the university when I was in high school, but there was no electric guitar, which is what I wanted to do. So I had to go to Boston to do that. And thank goodness. Mm-hmm. That's where I encountered this wider world. You know, it did me good.
Why jazz?
Hmm?
Why jazz?
Well, it didn't start as jazz. I mean, I started with Elvis and moved quickly to AC/DC, and from there to Black Sabbath and Iron Maiden and Ozzy Osbourne and Judas Priest.
Skipped over Led Zeppelin.
Yeah. They were a little, I came to them later in life, you know, but they were old hat. I mean, that Van Halen, Rush, this was the guitar oriented stuff of the day. You could put on the radio and that stuff was happening, right? It wasn't esoteric. So
mm-hmm.
I started with that and I was taking lessons. I'm very fortunate that I've always been able to connect with really good teachers. Mm-hmm. And I'm also fortunate enough that for whatever reason, I could recognize them and I took them seriously. So that's good. But one of my teachers turned me on to this guy named Alan Holdsworth. And Alan Holdsworth, if you've never heard his music, he's passed away a few years ago now. But this guy, the chords that he played, I was just like, oh my God, what is that? The harmony. It was almost parallel to me to that experience of seeing Father Brennan give the last rites to this old woman who's dying and died right there. In fact, there's some primordially human thing that resonates with me. I'm in no way saying everyone has to be interested in jazz guitar, for God's sake. But for me, that was a gateway. It still is. So when I heard the music of Alan Holdsworth, and that more sophisticated harmony and stuff, I was compelled to investigate this. And I did.
Were you taken at all by the more improvisational stuff like Coltrane and Miles Davis and Thelonious Monk?
It took me a while to appreciate that stuff because that just sounded old to me.
Okay.
It sounded old. You know, what the hell is that? I mean, that's, come on. But see, I couldn't hear it yet. See, this is the thing. Alan is we're really down a rabbit hole here, but he was a guitar player who had very sophisticated harmonies. Okay. And then when he improvises, he's like Coltrane. He has a distorted sound and he plays this beautiful legato. It's mind blowing stuff he does. And he was my entranceway. Because if I want to understand his harmony, now you start pulling back. Well, where did he come from? Where did that come from? All things lead to jazz and blues and then to Western classical music and Bach. And this thing all starts to unravel and become really beautiful, you know. So I went to Berkeley and then I did a master's at the New England Conservatory and then stayed on the East Coast as a jazz musician, gigging and playing and teaching for another decade past that. And I'm still learning about the tradition.
Was music samadhi inducing for you, like kind of absorption,
yeah,
type stuff?
Yeah, and that's the thing about the improvisation is it's spontaneous composition, like in the way that our conversation is right now. We're spontaneously composing what we're saying back and forth. We're listening to each other. Jazz is like that. It's musical, like it's playing with energy and sound, but it's a conversation that's being formed as it happens. And it's delicious. It's amazing to be able to communicate in the realm of music in the moment like that. In that way, I think it's a Zen art. It's a modern Zen art.
Yeah. I mean, the Grateful Dead certainly, I mean, they grew up as Beats, which, you know, and Zen was big for the Beats. I mean, they conceived of what they were doing as was Zen in action, for sure.
Yeah.
And I've said this before on this podcast, if it wasn't for psychedelics and the Grateful Dead, and it had to be both of them. Psychedelics by itself wasn't enough. Grateful Dead by itself wasn't enough. But the combination of those two,
interesting.
That's what got me into Zen, without question.
Fascinating. That's really interesting to me.
Yeah. I mean, just because I experience, you know, things that could be labeled with some Zen names, you know, even before I knew Zen existed, you know,
it's a human thing.
Yeah.
Corner on this market, you know, it gives us a way to work with it.
Yeah. It was just so compelling to me, you know, within 3 years I was living in a monastery, you know, so.
Well, good for you. That's great. Yeah. But I mean, this is the thing, like Upaya is real, you know, The thing is, okay, if you're playing, like in my case, if I'm on the mat practicing or a sword player, if I'm playing guitar or whatever, or in a good conversation for that matter, then the situation aligns at times to allow this flow state working samadhi to occur. Mm-hmm. But it's very tenuous because it depends on the circumstances. If anything in the circumstance falls out, the samadhi stops. Right. At least that's my experience. So like if you're playing with the right cats in the right venue and the sound is good and you like the music and the audience is the right way, if all these things line up, then maybe you'll go into this flow state 10% of the time where it's really happening. And that's amazing. And so what a lot of artists do is they find that in their medium and they keep pushing into the medium to make that deeper. But my view now is that there's only so far that a working samadhi can get you. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what Zen training does is enable a deeply concentrated state that can exist regardless of the circumstances. It doesn't depend on the circumstances. See, so, and again, it's not all about just being concentrated 24/7. I don't mean to give that impression, but when you talk about samadhi, that's what it is. And so that's why Sesshin is so important, because in Sesshin you set everything aside. You're not a jazz guitar player. You're not a 6-degree black belt in Aikido. You're not a schmo who can't do anything right. You're not a carpenter. You're no one in particular. Mm-hmm. Everything is stripped away. And thank goodness, because then you can actually just get down to confronting your mind directly without the toys. See? Yeah. And then
everyone becomes a schedule hater.
Everyone becomes a what?
A schedule hater. I'm just joking.
A schedule hater. Well, you need a sexier schedule. But no, I mean, you know, so I feel very strongly about that because I work with a lot of artists, musicians, and, you know, they're entrepreneurs like that, lawyers that are fantastic at what they do, and runners on and on and on, you know, for different people that can be chasing it through sexuality or a video game, all kinds of stuff. But the thing is that ultimately to catalyze Kensho, it has to be not situationally dependent. It has to be because you've practiced this with the most boring thing imaginable. Just sit there and breathe, right? And then, okay, now it starts to become power that you're generating rather than situationally conductive, or, you know, conducted by the situation. That's what I would say.
So how about for you? Did you dabble with psychedelics at all?
Never. No, not interested. Not interested. No, it never appealed to me. The kind of people in my sphere that were into that, I felt no resonance with. And interestingly, you know, as a martial artist, I've always been athletic. Okay. So that athlete side of me, I don't like that stuff. And I never have felt a resonance with it. I know people who have. But the other thing is, when I got to Boston, all the mentors that mattered to me in music, okay, there's some really significant teachers, Charlie Benakis, Mick Goodrick, people like this, they've all passed away now, sadly. But these were the massive titan figures in my world at the time. All of those guys had a Zafu in their room. They all had some kind of meditation practice going. The first cat I ever met who self-identified as a Buddhist, his name was Garrison Fuel, great guitar player in Boston, little known, but well, man. But he's like, yeah, I'm Buddhist. I'm like, what? That's a thing? I didn't even know you could be that. You know what I mean? Okay. And see, in the martial art world, your physical body is like a big deal, right? Mm-hmm. Rigorous training is a thing there. And I love that stuff. I really do. And in jazz, you see, they had seen all their heaviest cats decimated by heroin. Mm-hmm. It's in the DNA of the tradition that, oh, shit, this isn't good. At least when I was there, the people that I was around. OK, so the mentors that I looked to, they were old enough. They were our age. They were in their 50s then. OK, so their teachers were those guys who lost their friends, their colleagues, the talented people. They lost them all to these drugs. So they got a very clear, like, don't do that stuff, son. You know? So, right. Yeah. Not to say that it wasn't there, it probably was, but it just for me now. Now, I do know other folks like yourself who cite it as a primary influence and a healthy one. So,
yeah. And there's a big difference between psychedelics and heroin. I mean, it's not. Other than both being a chemical, there's almost no correlation. I've never done it, so I'm assuming, you know.
I tried
codeine when I was sick, so. So you were a pretty devout Catholic at one point in your life. Mm-hmm. Presumably you're not now.
No.
So what was the switch there? What precipitated you losing your faith or... However you want to term it.
You know, for me, I never had this big, oh, fuck you moment. You know, it really wasn't like that. I just kept growing into mysticism and into contemplative practice. And so, if the sacramental nature of the Eucharist, encountering God, you got this little cracker, okay. But, you know, when I see for myself that that's everywhere, that everything is a sacrament, that I'm a sacrament, that the divine is imminent everywhere, and it doesn't even need to be labeled that way. It's not even helpful, right? Then suddenly it's like the whole world is that, and I don't find that to be a useful. The thing that really doesn't rub me the right way, so to say, is this exclusionary metaphysics. Mm-hmm. Where either you do this or you're damned. Either you do this or you're going to burn in hell forever.
You never thought that way.
No. Well, I mean, when I'm a kid and father says, don't do this or you go to hell, you go, yes, father. But as soon as reason kicked on, I'm like, what the fuck? Come on. Come on, really? And I was lucky. I had a lot of good priests that I could have serious conversations with in that tradition. But ultimately, this is the thing. Like, Zen is really, really rigorous, right? It's a narrow path, man. This is not everybody's jam. Mm-hmm. But it's open to everybody. And if you see this thing all the way through, you don't come out an asshole, or you shouldn't, right? You come out realizing everybody is it. Mm-hmm. We're all, it's all everything, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like the only people who are count are the Zen Buddhist transmitted people. Come on. Yeah. It's not like that. Mm-hmm. And the tradition itself holds that, I think.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like your first interaction with kind of real Zen practice was when you went with your Aikido teacher to Zen Mountain Monastery.
Yeah.
Yeah. And had you read any Buddhist books or anything prior to that? Or did you have any, was Buddhism part of your consciousness at all?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the first book I ever bought on my own, or my mom bought for me at my insistence, was that Zen Mind Beginner's Mind. And then right after that, we went back to that bookstore, and I'm looking around and I find this amazing book that's got this calligraphy on the front, and I turn it over, and there's Suzuki Roshi's face, right? And I saw his face, and he's, you know, that picture that he's got there.
I'm like, Mom, eyebrows up.
Yeah. I'm like, Mom, I want this one. And she's like, what? I'm like, really? I want this book. Well, okay. She thought it was a martial art thing. So did I, frankly. Got it home, and we read that thing. I was learning how to read at the time. I couldn't read yet. But she would read that to me, and I'm kind of, you know, the thing when you're a kid and you put your finger and you follow the lines and all that stuff. And she would read the lines and, you know, do you understand? And we would say no and laugh. But like, you know, it was in there right away.
So planted a seed.
Mm-hmm. And I would say I'm very comfortable saying I am very comfortable with a pre-birth, rebirth. It makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. I claim no omniscient insight to this stuff, but I can understand how that explains quite conveniently some things that otherwise are very difficult to explain. Why was I so drawn to that book at such a ridiculously young age? Mm-hmm. Who the hell knows? But it was in there as a seed, right? And so years later, we go to the monastery, which is a good 5 hours away from Boston. Yeah. So I put all the stuff in the Subaru and head out, which is kind of fun, you know, road trip with sensei. You don't get to do that every day. Get to the monastery, and sensei goes in to register whatever he's got to do, and I'm going to schlep the stuff because that's my role. I'm 18. And there's this groundskeeper guy who's out there on a tractor, jeans, jean shirt, jean pants, and he's out there mowing the substantial lawn on this big ass tractor. And I grew up there. My Uncle John was on the farm. I know what a tractor is, you know. But I saw this guy, and I was just struck by his whatever. And I remember I just was looking at him, and I was watching him mow the grass at the monastery, this groundskeeper. And it was so palpable and powerful that I just lingered there watching him. I didn't realize that time was going by. Eventually, sensei comes out, Jay, bring the stuff in. Sorry, sensei, and grab the stuff, you know. Hmm. But it turns out, later that night, Roshi walks in full drag. That was him.
Okay.
He was the guy, he's the bald guy in the jean jacket mowing the lawn. And now he's walking in full drag with the whisk and all that stuff. And I had that same feeling. But now I had some kind of sense of, oh, wait a minute. Right. So there's something. So again, that's why that kinesthetic thing, that being in the presence of, is so important to me. All I've got is my experience up to now. That's all I got to reference. Right. But like that being in the presence, he didn't know me from jack shit. I didn't even know what he was. But that being in the presence of him and feeling that kinesthetic thing, absolutely critical. Mm-hmm. If I saw a picture of him on a tractor, yeah, whatever. You know what I mean? Even a picture of him in drag, whatever, I don't care. But being in the space, my cells could feel it. See, it's not an idea. it's a palpable, visceral thing. And luckily, like I said, I've got good karma around finding teachers. And so it turned out that I got to hear him give a Tay show and learned that there was an intro thing. And I think I'd like to do that, you know, and it kind of followed from there.
What were you guys even doing there? Were you up there to do a martial arts?
Yeah. Yeah. They used to have
seminar or something.
Yeah. They used to have Bill Sensei out there every summer to do an Aikido and Zen workshop.
And he was a Zen practitioner.
Yeah.
He was a student of
Daido.
Daido.
Mm-hmm.
And so was this your first experience of Zazen or any type of meditation?
Well, again, I was flirting with all the Catholic variants.
Mm-hmm.
But no, that's where I learned to sit. I remember getting instruction there and everything. Yeah.
What was your first impression of Zazen?
It was the most natural thing. It's just like laying down to take a nap or taking a simple walk or taking a drink of water when you need it. It's just the most natural, obvious, you know, to me anyway, it wasn't this big, fierce thing to get myself to do. It was just like, oh, thank God, finally, you know. Mm-hmm. It was a very relaxing, very empowering, very intuitive to me. I'm not saying it needs to be that way. I'm not even thinking that that's an advantage, actually. That kind of has a problem, too. Take it for granted, right? Mm-hmm. But for me, no, it's delicious. Absolutely exquisite and delicious right from the first.
Was this 80? You said you started your practice in 1987. Is this around
that time? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's when I went to Boston. It's all, when I landed there, it all just went bang, bang, bang. It just unfolded real quick. And I kept investigating, you know.
And did you, how soon until you start having a daily sitting practice yourself?
Right away. As soon as I knew what to do. That's all. As soon as it was pointed out to me, this is a thing you can do. I'm like, oh, imagine being six or whatever I was, and you're hearing the words of Zen mind, beginner's mind, but you have no idea what Zazen is.
Mm-hmm.
Not a clue in the world, right? You don't know that that refers to the seated thing. You got no idea. Well, as soon as I understood what it was about and could see it, see, and also, you know, to pull the metaphor of the Lord of the Rings, you know, Gondor is a cosmopolitan city. There's people from all over the place there, right? Not so much the Shire. So when I started actually seeing people that had a much wider worldview and had experienced a much wider world than I had, I feel that I had a very strong grounding and a healthy one in a loving family, which served me well, and I'm very grateful for. But I was able to see value, and I wasn't afraid of encountering these larger ideas. See? And, you know, back in the day, there's no Google. There's no internet searching. There's, you know, the best you got then is a good solid bookstore.
Yeah. I think I even, when I was shopping around for monasteries to go live with, one of them I considered was Zen Mount Monastery. And the way I found out about it was their ad in Tricycle.
I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's, otherwise, I would have had no idea it existed.
Yeah. I mean, back in the day, it was kind of easy. Once you figured out that those glossies exist, everything was there. And there was this fantastic bookstore on Newbury Street in Boston called the Trident bookstore. That's what it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They had a killing selection there. When I found a good bookstore that had a well-curated shelf, you know, I mean, to the younger people that are used to Googling anything they want, this might sound odd, but if you could find a good, well-stocked bookshelf was like a browser back in the day, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And so I was very lucky.
I went to school in Arcata, or I lived up in Arcata when I was in school, like Humboldt County in Northern California. And they had an amazing Zen and Buddhist section. I mean, hundreds of books. I mean, I'd spend, you know, 40 hours a week in there reading, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know. And then eventually, you know, I think the best thing that those books can do is convince you to go get connected,
mm-hmm.
for real.
Was there a local sitting group you sat with, or would you sit by yourself largely?
Well, you see, Bill Sensei, Gleason Sensei, was a student of Daido's, right? And so the dojo was there. And so as soon as I connected and started to understand what was going on. And, hey, Sensei, why don't we have a sitting group here? And he's like, well, that'd be great. So we started a sitting group, and that's where I met my wife, Karen, right? Mm-hmm. Who's transmitted, and we teach here together. Mm-hmm. She was studying Aikido. That's how we met. And she was studying Zen with Richard. And I was studying Zen with Daido, see? Mm-hmm. And she was at Episcopal Divinity School, and I was flirting with a Cistercian vocation. So, you know, this was, you know, we kind of ruined each other's, mistaken hopes for these other ways. And we found each other, thank goodness, and practiced together. And so we started a sitting group. So literally our relationship was formed and has been in the context of being a part of and facilitating sitting groups ever since we met.
Interesting. How long until you started doing regular trips up to Zen Mount Monastery?
Right away. Mm-hmm. As soon as I recognized what it was.
Mm-hmm. And did you read at what point were you aware that there was something called Kensho? Did you read three pillars of Zen or anything?
Yeah.
Like
that? Yeah. So. Yeah, but. The thing is that me as a younger man, right, I really wanted and needed structure and clarity and order and rules and that kind of shit, right? And then at a certain time, that's really helpful. And for me, it was. So the fact that I had a teacher now that was a living, breathing embodiment of this tradition, right, means that when I go in there and say, my practice is, you know, my name is Jay, my practice is counting my breaths, then there's a process that starts to unfold. And that became way more important to me than anything else, mm-hmm. is I want to get connected to that living embodiment of the tradition. And I want to do whatever the hell it is that you do. Mm-hmm. Look, if enlightenment is an actual thing that Homo sapiens can experience, then I want to experience that. Mm-hmm. I'm a Homo sapien. What the hell? You know, mm-hmm. like if it's true, then I want to know it's true. And if it's not, I want to prove that it isn't.
So you had an explicit desire for enlightenment pretty early on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also I would say of just a natural affinity for the thing. Mm-hmm. Honestly, it was just like a very, it was obvious. And it was also confusing, right? Because it didn't fit into the Catholic background I had grown up in. Mm-hmm. But it was also anciently familiar to me in some way. And so a lot of people come into practice through the gate of suffering and trauma and pain and misery and getting out of samsara and stuff like that. I have my share, to be sure. But my primary way in wasn't that. My primary way in was just a deep resonance with the thing. Like when I saw him mowing the lawn, mm-hmm. that's how it's been for me. When I felt it, then it's like, this is, I'm doing this. Bang.
How about a desire for knowing truth? Was that, you know, just like, what is it? Why am I here? What is this? Like, was that part of your great
sure. job, so to speak? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, all those classic things. Yeah, I used to walk around the city going, what the hell is this? What is this all about? You know, I would get to the point where I could play in a way that my younger self would have been aghast at wow, my God, you know, and I'm like, still, life still sucks. Wait a minute. I thought if I could play this cool thing, all would be great. And it turns out not so much. Well, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. For sure. For sure.
How soon until you did your first session?
Right away. To my memory. I did the Aikido and Zen thing, and then I did an intro weekend, and then I did a Zazen Kai, and then I did session. Ching, 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 ching.
Was it physically difficult for you?
No.
No. You're one of those people.
not at that time.
Yeah.
You know, it's... I mean, I used to have to shift posture all the time, you know, this one, Seiza, chair. I mean, I had to flip around, and turns out I have a mild scoliosis that I didn't know about that I've learned about, and mm-hmm. tinnitus. Like, oh, great. What's that? You know, I mean, you know, challenges came up. I'm not saying it was just simple and easy for me. I mean, session is hard, man. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. But the strain and difficulty of it is natural to me. Mm-hmm. That's what would say.
Did you, were you able to develop some samadhi pretty quickly?
I think so.
Yeah. And, what would they give you breath counting to start with? And then,
Yeah. Breath counting and the hara, the one point, you know, keep the mind in the one point, the still point, that stuff.
And what would you have, did you have Dokusan experiences early on, or was it mostly just being seminar type situation?
No, session. See, this is the thing. And that's why I'm so session heavy is I didn't go and live at the monastery. I was in the city. I was getting my credential. Mm-hmm. I was studying Aikido. I was courting my to-be wife. I was living a life. And then I would go and pause all that and show up at session and just sink in. Mm-hmm. And that's all about Doksan and doing the thing, liturgy positions, all that stuff. And then, okay, it's done. Get your ass back to the city and live. Mm-hmm. So my whole training has been that model of back and forth, back and forth, back and forth until eventually it just merged, you know? But Doksan was prime.
And so early on, they let you have Dokusan with Daido.
If you're at Sashin.
Yeah. How was he in the Dokusan room?
I mean, we're going back here, right? I mean, he was an excellent teacher. And this is just all personal, right? I mean, if you talk to a bunch of different people, you get different stories about anybody, including me, right? Different people. Oh, how's Rinzen as a teacher? You'll get different impressions based on their interface. Nonetheless, mine, he was really good for the first 10 years, you know, order, clarity, system, do this, not that. This kind of shit was very good. And I'm the kind of person that at that age, I needed that. It was good for me at that time. See. But once we started getting into koan study, he became far less gentle and caring, and got pretty severe pretty quick. Mm-hmm. And that was fine. I was okay with that. But
so he would go into like Japanese samurai mode.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. American drill sergeant. I mean, you know, yeah. It's a human quality, right? It's not just the Japanese that do that stuff, but yeah, it got severe. And listen, I can be that way too at times and for very specific reasons, mm-hmm. like a surgical application. It's fine, but it's not like my primary way of relating to students. You know,
well, one thing I've heard about Daido is he would kind of hold back if you weren't a residential monastic student. Like, you know, he didn't really consider you like a full Zen student. I don't know if it's accurate or fair assessment. Well, or maybe it changed over time too. Who knows?
I can only speak to my own experience. Mm-hmm. But it's when we got married. All right. And Doan and I, we had a wedding at the monastery after a session. You know, we had the public one at Boston University for everybody's family, which again was Catholic. And then we had a separate wedding at the monastery after session in our gray robes. It was great. That was fine. But once we had our daughter, okay, once Isabella was born in 2000, and then it became very clear that we had made a choice. We're not doing the monastic life. And again, for him, ordination is conflated with living as a monastic on those grounds. Okay. Mm-hmm. And now that's his call. And everybody has to make calls when you're in that seat. I get it. Right. But as soon as we were not candidates for that, I would have to put my hand up and say, yeah, I too felt a real shift in, how he viewed me and interacted with me and what I had access to and didn't. Mm-hmm. And then Myotai, who received transmission from him, a few years later, she was installed as the abbot of Fire Lotus in Brooklyn. And then she, a year after that, left and started teaching on her own. And I was pissed. I was very upset about that. I was so upset. And but it's funny though. So, but I had the presence of mind to call her and have a conversation. I didn't just feel pissed and not say anything. I said, wait a minute, what's going on here? A teacher leaving their students? What the hell is this? And so with some respect, but still a lot of arrogance, honestly, I called her. I emailed her, hey, and she said, I'd like to talk if you'd like to. I said, I would love to talk. And I talked and I said, why are you doing this? Well, turns out she had an answer. Mm-hmm. She had a good answer. She had a great fucking answer, as a matter of fact. I was like, really? I had no idea. I mean, she had perspectives I would never consider. Like, she wanted to teach in ways that weren't the mountains and rivers order of 8 gates and 10 stages and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a way. That's not the only way, right? And that's true of all of it. And frankly, it's a great way. It works beautifully for a lot of people. But there's other ways, it turns out. And they're also valid. Hello. There's not just one true way to do this shit. It's just not true. No matter how slamming a particular approach may be, it's just an approach, okay? So there we are. So now I had a conversation with Miotai, and she said, you know what? I want to do a session. I'm going to rent space at Garrison. Would you like to come out? Not creating a poll or anything, because at the time I'm Daido's student. And I said, well, I tell you what, since we moved back to Toledo in 2001, and this is now 2003 or 4, something like that, I don't know. So look, doing session at the monasteries just kind of sucks because I have to leave Karen home with the kid and I travel 14 hours or whatever to get there. And she's here alone with the kid. And it's just really tough, right? And there's no way for her to go to session because Isabella's a little baby. She can't stay just with me. It's not going to work. She needs mom. That's how it is. So could I bring Karen and our daughter Isabella? And she said, yeah, we'll make that work. Bring her. Mm-hmm. You're on. We'll do it. We made arrangements, put Isabella in the car seat. Off we went to Garrison and did a session, okay, that allowed us to be there as a family. Now, we're not rookies at that point. We both have some, 15, 20 years in at that point. But we could take turns in and out of the Zendo, doing childcare. We would both be there for the talk and have Isabella cooled out somehow. And we made it work. And it worked great. And for the first time, I saw that there was a way other than just this one way to actually do this thing. Mm-hmm. And so we formally switched over and I formally became Yotai Sensei student.
That caused drama?
It was just a natural evolution, honestly, because now I'm a married man with a kid, mm-hmm. and a job.
You're already outside of the circle of trust anyway, I guess.
I'm not a prime candidate, and listen, the Roshi's got the job of finding people they can transmit to. And if he's convinced monasticism is the way to do that, I bow to his decisions. Mm-hmm. And I didn't fit that model at that time. And I got a bow to that too. Okay. Mm-hmm. So Miotai expressed the possibility of a way of doing deep training that didn't rely on living on those grounds. Mm-hmm. In a way that made sense to me.
So I want to bookmark her. I'm going to go back a little bit in the history of it. Mm-hmm. You talk about how soon after you started were you given Mu?
Barry, it's hard for me to remember that. From 87, I started with him, and then I was with him till say 2002 or 3 or something like that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It took me a while. I didn't just sit down and like crack through Mu on my first day or anything like that.
How long until he assigned you Mu? Like, was it?
It had to have been at least. Well, it depends how you gauge these things, right, Barry? But I mean, I would say probably 5 years. if I had to put a guess on it.
So you
could have been 10. It could have been 3. Honestly, I can't remember.
So it was years into your practice before you were assigned to me.
Oh, hell yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But see, here's the way I see. I don't think thinking about it in years is actually the right way to think about it. I think the way to think about it is how many days of session. Huh? See, because one, and this is where the monastic thing has a valid point. If your ass is there, you're doing 12 sessions a year. That's now, if you're a lay person and you can get there twice a year, there's a very different reality here. And you just got to accept that that's true. Right. So it was so many years. Yes. But like I would do maybe 4 sessions a year and I would do them and I would do the whole week, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was very disruptive to life, but fuck it. That's what I'm here for. So I would make it work and patch it up when I got back. And so I was consistent like that once I figured out what it was. And because I was there for those multiple days, you know, when you get into day 4 and 5 and 6, you're in a very deep place compared to day 1 mm-hmm. of retreat. That's just how it is. So that the way I would think about it is it might have been somewhere around 100 days.
Of session.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. I'd have to sit around and do some math. I'd have to get my abacus out and figure that out. But there was a, you know, it was a natural progression. I'm really grateful for this. I didn't just fly right into this. I took a lot of time just connecting to the one point in the breath and getting that samadhi for real. Mm-hmm. And that I would never want to rush anybody through that. That'd be a horrible disservice.
Mm-hmm. And once you were assigned Moon, you were working on it. Were you able to dig into it pretty quickly, pretty completely?
Well, I mean, I struggled with it as everybody does. Most people do. I didn't just hear the koan once and respond impeccably first take. I mean, not at all. I mean, it was
as far as your absorption into Mu, like the
And see, this is why I say, in my experience, Daido was a really good teacher for those first 10 years, because until that samadhi was actually palpable, that shit is not happening mm-hmm. in my experience, and that's the way it ought to be. Mm-hmm. If someone's samadhi really isn't developed, then this is just another thought bouncing around in their head, and it's harmful.
Were you able to hold Mu throughout, you know, once you're back in Toledo and working and taking care of babies and making dinner and chopping? Were you holding Mu fairly well through that stuff, or was it largely a session exercise?
Well, I had my daily sitting thing going on more days than not, you know. So when I would sit, I was pretty good about that. But I wasn't married yet. I didn't have the kiddo yet. You know, I was just a
young guy. Oh, you didn't? Okay.
No. I can't place the timeline of it, but I was trying to get my credential in the world, making my way in the world as a musician and stuff. That's a project, you know, mm-hmm. and pursuing my Aikido practice. These things are all kind of together. But the thing that's the same about all of those things for me, they're all practices. You practice the guitar, you get onto the mat, and you practice Aikido, you sit on the zafu, you practice your practice. So the idea of practicing and taking practice seriously is kind of central to my experience. So it wouldn't be weird for me to practice. That's mm-hmm. like what I do. And then what I did as a livelihood is I taught other people how to practice guitar. You know, it's natural. Mm-hmm. You got an instrument. You're only going to get so good messing around in your room with your guitar. You got to go get a teacher, right? That's how it works. So you go, you get a teacher, you get some lessons going, and then that only goes so far. Eventually, you got to get into a band, or what are we doing here, right? And that's showing up and getting connected to a teacher, and not just you and the teacher. This is, again, a problem with fixating on Doksan and over Zoom, if that's all you're thinking about, because you're missing playing with the band. Mm-hmm. It's not just seeing the teacher and resonating and stuff. That's there. But ultimately, playing in the band means being a part of a sangha, right? The sangha is the thing, man, like connecting with the community of practice and being enmeshed and connected with the community of practice. That's not incidental. That's not a throwaway. That's right. Like oxygen for the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. So with all that in context, like, I'm asking this kind of with a little bit of a ulterior motive. You know, people who, I'm just wondering how, like, with your depth of experience and practice at that point, when you were saying Mu, were you holding it as you're going through daily life at all, or was it mostly a zazen thing? Like as you're like driving to the school, were you able to hold Mu pretty consistently at that point?
I think so. I mean, I was, you know, I would take the subway, you know, and so that's easier.
We don't have a subway.
Boston does.
Oh, you're in Boston. So, okay. I messed up with the timeline.
It was easy to do. It's a long one. But, you know, yeah, I mean, we're talking about when I initially started Muji, right? The Mu checking questions, like that first blush thing. Mm-hmm. I'm still very much living in Boston, and I'm, you know, living in the city, and I'm getting my credential, the master's or whatever. So yeah, it was around, you know, but at that point I had been very acclimated to having keeping the one point all the time and being practicing awareness of the breath when I'm doing whatever I'm doing. So it's very natural, right? If a person doesn't have seriously verified chops and capacity that demonstrably shows up to keep their mind in the one point in the hara in daily life, they have no chance, in my view, of keeping Mu together during daily life. And I'm not necessarily even sure they ought to, honestly. But yeah, so I think the question is, the answer is probably yes. But as soon as I start engaging in stuff, no, then I'm going to be doing whatever I'm doing, you know. Mm-hmm. If I'm at the dojo and we're doing whatever practice we're doing, I can't be thinking about Mu. I'm getting my ass handed to me.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about passing Mu, what that experience was like for you?
Yeah. I mean, it was a classic hotbox experience, you know, come to find out. I mean, I was a classic right down the middle of the road kind of guy with this. You know, I maintain that many people have opening experiences prior to koan study. Mm-hmm. I think this is a human experience. Zen has no corner on this market. However, we have a very clear and systematized way to catalyze that and to recognize it and integrate it and, frankly, get beyond it. Okay. So that all that said, yeah, he had the classic, you know, you count the breaths. I still teach this way. Count the breaths. And then eventually you count the cycle of the breath. And then you quit counting altogether and you follow the breath, right? Mm-hmm. And then eventually when that starts to ripen up, and again, these are stages that can take a long time, then I have students start following Mu if it's appropriate, right? And that's just make the sound Mu and actually intone it, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's certain things that have to happen with that. There's a few other ancillary practices that support this. And then eventually the question gets popped. And then now the dynamic changes. See, once you do that, you can't undo that. So that has to be done very carefully. And that's
what are you referring to? I'm sorry, the question popped.
Yeah, like there are checking questions.
Oh, you're saying after someone passes Mu, then
what? No, before they pass Mu at all.
Okay,
it's tough because I don't really want to publicly say what the checking questions are and all that. Yeah. But there's a point where someone's following Mu, mm-hmm. just making the sound and merging with Mu. Okay, there's a bit about dropping the witness that has to happen, and then there's catalyzing prods that happen, right? And once you go with this question or two, or there's a couple of ways in there, you can't take that back because the student has encountered that now, and that's an intense thing. And so once that's happened, now the dynamic shifts, right? And then it starts to be like, well, what about this? Right. And so I'm very cautious about that. You're right. Cause like I said, I don't think that can be undone. Once you put the question out there, or once you've engaged the student in that way, it starts becoming a little, maybe a lot more confrontational, less discursive. Biography is long gone. We're not about trading biographies at that point. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And so for me, he did that and it was great. I mean, it sucked. It was hard. It was really hard, man. Mm-hmm. You know, because I'd travel, you know, you move mountains to be able to go and do a week session and go in there. And he's got the same thing coming at me. And I'm everything I can muster is just not working. Classic belly flops, one after the next. Airball, belly flop, not seeing it. Frustrating as all hell. And thankfully, for whatever reason, I had the gumption to stick to it. And thankfully, also, he didn't start weakening and oh, they're there. None of that stuff with him. He was very good about this, you know, I would say. And so it took many sessions, years, a couple of years anyway, with this one question, this one confrontational thing. And then finally, at last, it popped and it did exactly the way the stories describe, you know. Mm-hmm. And I went into that Dokesun room and I was a lion. I was not going to be intimidated or turned around. It was just clear and obvious. It was hilarious how obvious. And I know it, and I know it. Right. And so that's the arrogance of the first insight. But I had it, and you need it at that moment. Later, you got to get rid of that or you're done for. But at that time, that's needed. Mm-hmm. And I had it in spades. He gave that jab and I went, boom. And I gave it right back at him. And he went, oh, well, what about this? Mm. And I went, shoom, bang. And we had this beautiful, now we're playing jazz. Now we're, oh, thank God. Now I know enough. I'm experiencing enough to actually be able to play. I can play now. I can finally fucking play. Thank goodness. This is great. So he threw, I don't know, I can't remember, but a bunch of these various checking questions at me. And mm-hmm. I was just, you know, not, I wasn't like that for the rest of my life or anything. Eventually, of course, like everybody else, I got stuck on something, but not for a while. But it was a long, slow boil to get mm-hmm. to that first pop.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
How would you, if you're comfortable talking about it, how would you characterize the wisdom of the shift that precipitated you being able to pass move? Like, if you could put it in a sentence, what was your insight?
Well,
I have an ulterior motive for asking this because there's so I've talked to lots of Zen teachers, you know, through this podcast and just through my life.
I've noticed, yeah.
And we have a lot of like off the record talks about, you know, what is your criteria for passing people on Mu?
Sure.
Some people, so one end of the spectrum is, you know, you can answer the question. It doesn't matter any internal shift. If you can answer the question, you're moving on through the curriculum with the assumption that somewhere down the curriculum, there will be the shift. Okay. So that's one end. That's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is maybe, you know, you have to see clearly there's no self. And even that needs to be, you need to be even beyond that. So, you know, and so there's a huge, you know, it's somewhere in the middle. And I found a lot of times with like maybe, I won't say what lineage, but, you know, just a intuitive glimpse at the source of this all, that's enough to pass Mu. You know, but still there's somebody noticing a source, you know, but they'll pass me with it. So I'm curious.
Yeah, I get you.
Where would you put yourself on that spectrum of what allowed you to pass Mu? And then the follow-up question is, what are you looking for in your students to pass Mu along that spectrum? Or do you disagree with my spectrum? You know?
Well, you know, I feel pretty strongly that this doesn't just go one way. Mm-hmm. Okay. Every student comes in with an entire universe of karma, strengths and shadows, affinities and non-affinities, okay? Mm-hmm. And all of them can be used as upaya. Mm-hmm. So like, I don't really think that there's just one way this goes. Okay. I've been doing this a long time now.
For the record, I totally agree with you, but go ahead.
Yeah, and I've been doing this a while now. Isn't my first rodeo with working with people. I'm frankly pretty good at this, mm-hmm. right? And so it's a, again, it's an in-person felt physicalized thing that is the basis around which I can make these calls. Right. And so for some people, I will accept nothing less than a pretty full on experience. And for some people, them being able to respond adequately enough is adequate enough. Mm-hmm. And it depends. I was just kind of a stupid answer, but that's how it is. It actually, the thing is that the place where a koan gets resolved from is the place that I teach from. Mm-hmm. So I'm not teaching from a check sheet. I have one, but I'm not teaching from that. I know it, but I'm not slaved to it. Okay. Mm-hmm. If I'm in front of a student, and again, I can't do this with pixels. I can't. Maybe somebody can. I cannot. I got to be in the room. I got to smell you. I got to feel this. I got to feel what it's like when you walk in the room. Mm-hmm. Like my skin feels that, right? This is all part of it. Mm-hmm. And so when I get that communication together, then there's this kind of movement that happens. And in the same way that the koan has to, it can't come from the intellect. Even if your response from the intellect is quote unquote correct, it sucks because it's coming from the wrong spot. It's got to come from the hara up. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's where my responses as a teacher come from also. So I'm also demonstrating to the student every time Dharma eye, koan mind. Mm-hmm. That's where the teaching comes. That's where what I'm doing is coming from. So in response, sometimes my Dharma eye will accept one kind of answer from a certain student that my Dharma eye will not accept from another.
Mm-hmm. How about from your own experience, where along that spectrum was your shift that pushed you through moon? If you feel comfortable sharing that,
the problem with that is that people start thinking they have to be like me or whoever they're listening to. And that's kind of a fallacy, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like the way Sonny Rollins plays the blues is not the way John Coltrane plays the blues, is not the way B.B. King plays the blues. So it's not how Louis Armstrong played it or Miles or Bill Evans or any, you know, name your guy. But you can tell a blues is a blues, right? Or like a jazz standard is a jazz standard. So there's a thing there that you can tell, like they're playing the tune. Mm-hmm. But Bill Evans does not sound like McCoy Tyner, nor should he, goddammit.
Right. And expand your analogy, not everybody needs to sound like McCoy Tyner to pass moot.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
But they have to be playing the blues.
Right.
And that so, I can tell.
So to go back to the narrative, you were working with Trace Roshi. Was it Trace? Is that, am I saying that right?
Miyotai.
Yeah. How long did you work with her?
5 years.
5 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And then you at some point you switched to Ford Roshi, right?
Yeah.
Could you talk about why and how you switched?
Yeah. Yeah. Happy to. I mean, Miyotai Sensei, and I still, you know, bow to her and owe her much and have a fondness for her, and we're in touch here and there. Mm-hmm. She again showed that the Mountains and Rivers Order is not the only way. It is a way. It's not the only way, right? And she had a very different way. And so she did four sessions a year, and I did every single one of those, and I was her. I was the, to my knowledge, I'm the only person she ever acknowledged as Shuso. She had us take the precepts again. She gave me the name Rinsen, which is the Dharma name that I use still. And she acknowledged me as a Shuso, and that was in 2007. And that's when I could start doing, you know, Dharma talks and stuff. But basically, she did not want to do the classic koans in the classic way. She was working with the Buddhist nun Rengetsu, and so she came up with Rengetsu koans that she did. She had a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon one time that was the koan. It was, yeah, she's doing all this kind of out of the box stuff, and it was really great.
Hirata Roshi had the Calvin and Hobbes.
Is that so? No, I didn't know that. Yeah. So, you know, again, like, you know, Daido's young, right? It's this way. This is how it's done. Chunk, chunk, chunk. Miotai's yin, man. You never know what the hell is going to happen. Your practice is get a puppy. I mean, it's just beautiful because, see, now that's what I needed then. See, mm-hmm. And too much of this rigor, always this way stuff, that can start to go counter as well. Too much of any medicine will cause a sickness. That's how it is. So she was a complete counter to the organization of the monastery, right? She's chaos woman, right? And it's great. It is fucking great. And Isabella's running around and we're dealing with it and it's all fine. And the progress and the practice is happening. And I'm kind of her number one or two, helping her organize. That's where I learned a lot about what to and not to do to help actually make a sangha happen. Mm-hmm. However, she suffers from health conditions that are serious. And eventually it became the case that she could no longer facilitate sesshin. And so towards the end there, she'd be having the sessions booked and we'd all have the time set aside. And then at the ninth hour, I just can't do it. I'm not well enough. And she canceled the session. And this happened a couple of times. And eventually she said, you know what, everybody, I just can't really do this right now. Mm-hmm. And she retired, you know. And that was heartbreaking for everybody, but just authentic and honest, you know. The schedule and its rigors were beyond her reach at the time. So as all this is going on, Toledo's growing. Okay, so it goes from a little sitting group to a bigger and bigger thing. We, you know, the Sangha has always kind of followed wherever I was going for my teaching. And so when she stopped, we gave it a year for this to settle out. And is this really true, or is this a phase, or is she going to come back online, or what's happening? She didn't know, in fairness. Nobody did. So after a year, it was clear that in the foreseeable, this was not going to happen again, her actively teaching. And so we set out to find what to do. And so that's when I, you know, encountered Father Kevin and James Ford, Myohan Roshi. So mm-hmm. He was then forming the nascent Boundless Way Zen project. And so I, you know, I went and did a, you know, I booked time at the Trappist Monastery. It was funny because it's very hard to book time there, right? So I would drive. I drove there in my car and was parked outside the monastery, the St. Joseph's Abbey it is. I just lived in the car. And, you know, they chant they do the chanting stuff, the psalms and all that. So yeah, I'd go in and be a part of that. And then I go back out to the car, you know. And then I got a gym membership at a gym at a town a couple hours away so I could shower up and stuff. But I got to meet with Father Kevin once a day, see. Mm-hmm. And so we worked through the Mumon Con with he and I worked on that. And then I learned about James Ford. And so I told Father Kevin, look, I need to go see this other guy and see. And the thing with Father Kevin is he was really good to help me resolve my Catholic stuff. Mm-hmm. He's impeccable at that. And also he knew that there are certain things he could never do for me. He couldn't ordain me, you know, that he's not ordained in the Zen tradition himself. Mm-hmm. Example of a lay person in Zen who's a deep person of the way. Anyway, then I went and did a session with James and he had the Boundless Way thing happening. At that time, they were renting a space, I think up in New Hampshire it was. And I had a similar thing with James. Like, actually, there was a time when, at that first session where we were the last ones out for some reason. He was in the Dokusan room late and the person left and then he was there and I was straightening the cushions for some reason. And we kind of closed up the building and walked together to where the cabins were, whatever it was. And we never talked. We just walked side by side in the beautiful New Hampshire night air or whatever. And it became impeccably clear to me, just like when I saw Roshi, Daito Roshi, mowing the lawn, there was a similar embodied kinesthetic fact that became very clear. And I knew then, okay, this is my teacher. Mm-hmm. And I've never talked with Roshi about that, actually, but that's how I knew. Because I know, again, though, Barry, because I know what it feels like to be in the room and feel that. Right. And, you know, so there it was. Bang. So I thanked Father Kevin for his help and became James' formal student and have never regretted that. He's a fantastic. He's exactly the teacher that I needed. And frankly, me at that time, I'm a dangerous student because I'm already got decades and decades in. And I've already got a group going, and things can get funny, man. Things can get really weird. People can get all egoic or self-declared and everything. I mean, I have a lot of respect for James because he's kind of a specialist in a way at helping people that are really advanced finish up. He's got an incredible skill for this. And now in my position here, I have people like that that come here once in a while, and I can see how challenging that scenario actually is in a way, you know.
That actually segues to my next question is, did he make you start over the curriculum, or did you just pick up where you left off? Or, but you were doing the White Plum curriculum before, right? And then you switched to the...
Yeah.
Yeah, and someone I know who's done both.
Here's the thing. I was doing the classic White Plum as far as I know.
Yeah.
And then... Myotai is like, no, fuck it. We're not doing that. We did Rengetsu Koans and Calvin and Hobbes, and we did whatever else. Okay, cool. And then with Father Kevin, okay, let's do the Mumonkan again. So we do that.
So you went back, you redid the Mumonkan with him.
Yeah. And then when I got to James, I was somewhere in the Mumonkan. I had that with me. Oh, let's play with that. So we picked it and we started. And then after, I kept coming back is the thing, you know. This is the other thing, like, you know, I now know if someone says, oh, you know, I want to study kind, fine, come and do session. And if they actually do, that's one thing, and usually they don't, or they do one, you don't see them again, problem solves itself, right? However, for me, I'm like, whoa, wait a minute, this guy has got the Soto priestly transmission, and he's got the Harada Yasutani koan curriculum. And for me, that's the jam. I wanted to go back and do the whole koan curriculum. I appreciate that Myotai wanted to explore other things. I benefited by that, to be sure. But I want to play the classic tunes, man. I really do. I want to know that I can speak bebop and like everybody else. So anyway, he met me where I was. And then after, I don't know, a retreat or two, he said, you know, how would you feel if we started over? And I'm like, you know, I would be really grateful to do that. I would love the chance to actually just start over because I would love that. Now, if I had been an asshole and said, why, no, you're not doing that. Why, I've worked hard to get here and all this and that. Boom. Out on your ear. And I should have been. I would, you know. But actually, my honest response is, no, thank you. I would really love to, because it's been 5 years plus another one, plus another. Yeah, 5 years with Myotai, and then a year off, which kind of sucked, and then a year trying to figure things out with Kevin. I would love to just start over. So we did.
And by start over, do you mean back to the miscellaneous or start over?
Oh, before that, the very first mood checking question.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And see, so of course it went pretty quickly, right? But I'm not a kid at that point. I mean, I've been around the block, but we went from the first one, you see.
Yeah.
And it's a significant thing worth mentioning, I suppose. I don't know if anyone's actually going to listen to this conversation, Barry. This is going on quite long. But if you have listened, you have a black belt in podcast listening at this point, officially.
But what people do is they come back and watch it in batches, according to the statistics.
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah, I like long-form conversations myself.
Yeah.
But let me get to where I was going, because the thing that I've come to understand is that Daito and Myotai, they didn't use notes with the koans. to my knowledge anyway. Mm-hmm. There was a clear in-house set of mood checking questions in the miscellaneous case, you know, but mm-hmm. and then the rest of the collections are all in order and they're publicly available. But the thing about Myohan Roshi, and he received from Tarrant, who received from Aitken, right, Roshi, is that there are these notes. And so whenever I would, when James would say, oh, let's do a koan, he would pick up this notebook. I'm like, what the fuck is that? This dude needs a notebook? What's wrong with him? That's what I really thought, because I had never seen that before. It turns out, though, it's an amazingly awesome thing, because you have in those notes, you have a variety of awesome responses from different voices in the lineage, and they're not all the same. Mm-hmm. All right? They're not all the same. And what I realize now is that every Zen teacher inevitably, definitely me, and everybody else, I think, you have strengths and you have weaknesses. Like, no shit, but that's true. So what people do, if you're left to your own, you're going to lean into what's strong and you're going to kind of, the other thing's going to atrophy, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're an emptiness heavy guy, you're going to lean into that emptiness shit all the time and you're not going to even notice that the other thing is atrophying, mm-hmm. especially if you're the lone guy on the top of the mountain teaching without any peers. Now, that's a prescription for pain. Mm-hmm. That's doomed. That shit is doomed, right? But these notes, well, wait a minute, there's automatic correctives built in there. So what I do with my students is we'll work on a case, and if she does a good job, they do a good job, and okay, we're good. And then we'll review all the different responses from the lineage together. Mm-hmm. And I really do liken that to, hey, this is how John Schofield played it. This Pat Metheny sounds like this. Oh, check out what Wes Montgomery did on this tune. That's a nice line.
And do you guys go through the verses and stuff like that too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure what you're talking about, like the verses in the Mumunkan?
Or, yeah, they're also in the Blue Cliff record.
Blue Cliff, right? Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's central, you know. But, the thing, too, about the koans is that it's not the case that all one needs to do is just, it's no more the case that you need to just have this one Kensho and all is well. Then it's the case that you have to just pass through the curriculum and then all is well. Mm-hmm. It's not actually true. I mean, the thing is that the Kensho is there's an ongoing tumbling into, integrating and forgetting about, and then tumbling into again. It's like falling in love over and over again with your spouse of 30 plus years marriage. Right. It's not a one and done goddamn thing. You don't just love her once or love your partner once and then now you're in love forever. It's not like that. It's a living, breathing relationship. It has many phases and many different seasons. Yeah. And there's, mm-hmm. you fall in love differently as you watch your child be born and as you watch them suffer and you yada yada. You know what I'm saying? And Kensho, in my experience, is like that. Again, it's human, man. It's a very human thing. Mm-hmm. So, of course, when I see my wife, I remember being a young dude laying eyes her the first time. Sure. But you know what? We're older now. I see her even more lovingly with a more mature view that isn't attracted by all the same features I was back in the day. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so like the koan system is, you don't want to fetishize it, but you can't, in my opinion, you need it, particularly if you're not a monastic. Mm-hmm. I think if you're living in a cloistered environment for 30 years and you're just sit, I think that can work. But I think if you're not in a monastic setting where you're living there, breathing the same air, then I'm not sure. What I feel strongly is that the koan system guides people into a way of practicing and realizing awakening that actually can transfer into daily life.
Yeah. The advantage of it, I would definitely not say it's necessary. I know plenty of people who are, I think, are quite open and they've never done a koan in their life. But for me, it was pretty important because I definitely was stuck in this thing where, like, I'm a thing. That's all absolute reality, which is a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like after, you know, down the road, that's kind of what had solidified, which is such a perversion.
It's almost inevitable, and
Kwan very quickly showed me the error of that way, you know. Yeah, and so that's why it was valuable to me, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. So we're like well into 2 hours of this. I want to ask you kind of one last question before we wrap up.
Yeah.
So at what point in your training were you given permission to do koans or even mu? Was it once you were done with the entire curriculum, or were you working with students prior to that?
The only empowerments I got no empowerments from Daido ever.
Mm-hmm.
I was a Shokan student, and then I received Jikai from him. And, you know, I was a koan student, and that's that.
Mm-hmm.
Myotai Sensei, after the last session she ever did in that incarnation, I don't know if she's done others since then or not. I think not. But anyway, she acknowledged me as Shuso there. Mm-hmm. And so I did a Dharma combat. I used Bankai's unborn mind as a something. And then I started giving Dharma talks. And then that was her last session, interestingly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never got empowerments from Kevin, Father Kevin. And then with Myo and Roshi, James Ford, then the Boundless Way system had these gradated empowerments that they kind of took from David Rennick. Roshi is there, and he was involved in the Kwannum sect, okay, right. The Korean lineage. And they had this thing called, was it
Dharma Holder or something?
No, it was like practice leader, teacher, senior Dharma teacher. I think, though, I might be messing that up, but Dharma Holder is Denkai.
Okay.
Okay. So anyway, so it, you know, I had a potentially very uncool situation. It was actually very cool, but it could have been funny because I already had people practicing here, right?
Were you giving Dokusan?
No.
Or an informal practice discussion, no one-on-one meeting with students?
No. I'm a by-the-line kind of guy. I don't push those things. But, you know, whatever Myotai allowed me to do, I did. So she said, okay, I want you to start giving talks. Yes, Sensei, what should I talk about? And she said, well, there's this book called The Roaring Stream. I want you to start from the beginning and just go all the way through that thing. So I did that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anyway, Myo and Roshi, after we went back to the koans and then moved through the questions and miscellany and stuff, you know, then at a certain point, the question about ordination came up, being recognized as a senior Dharma teacher came up. You know, and in that system, then there was gradated derivative authority to begin doing practice interviews, which as soon as I could under his guidance, I did.
Mm-hmm.
And we do verbatims, and it was just very adult, you know, grown-ups in the room, and just kind of move from there.
Cool. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Want to wrap up here, or want to go another 2 hours?
Well, I am a professor, so I can just keep talking. But I mean, honestly, you know, if anybody's actually listened all the way through this,
people do.
I hope you found some benefit in it, you know. And I guess I would just, you know, come back to saying, look, no one teacher or sect or approach is anything close to the one true way. It's mm-hmm. just not the case. There are lots of ways, but you got to find the way that works for you. Because if you should be playing in the Duke Ellington band, but you're sitting in there in the Count Basie band, that sucks because they're different bands. You got to find the right band. And it's not just about you and the teacher. It's about you and the teacher and the Sangha. So if anybody's listening to this and they said, gosh, what advice do you have? I would say, you know, really, it's never been easier, especially with the stuff Barry's doing here. You can sit here in Barry's podcast and you can get a pretty good sense.
The reason I thought you were talking about Barry Magid or something. I'm like, what?
No. I mean, you, dude. I mean, you can get a sense of different teachers and how they approach things and how they think about stuff and all that, you know. But eventually it's important to stop shopping and to actually put your nickel down and get connected, right? Mm-hmm. And really, really plug in, you know. And to me, that means at some point you got to show up. Right. And I personally, I would drive past 10 other teachers to get to the one that I actually have that resonant simpatico thing with, mm-hmm. because one doksan with that person is more beneficial than 10 with someone with whom you're not really connecting to.
Yeah. Like some people shop by teachers by tradition, and I can't imagine a worse decision. We're like, I want to be in Rinzai. And so I'm going to look for, I found a Rinzai teacher because I wanted to do Rinzai.
I think so because
like that resonance and two puzzle pieces fitting together, I think that's the most important thing by far.
It is. And you know, the lineage is like one of the sorting filters, mm-hmm. you know, but it's not all important, you know. Yeah. Like there are all kinds of martial arts styles, and really the most important thing is like, what's the quality of the teacher? Mm-hmm. That's the most important thing. The style is second.
Right.
So awakening is a real thing. It's not a myth. It's not a fairy tale. It's not a trick. It's real. And you deserve it, goddammit. Whoever you are, you know, and whatever it takes for you to actually find this, you should do. Because you know what? You can. Yes, you can. You just got to get connected. You got to get a teacher in a community and then just do it. You'll be fine.
All right. And then, so if someone wants to reach out to you, is the best way through the Buddhist Center of Toledo, or is that what it's called?
Buddhist Temple of Toledo.
Yeah, Buddhist Temple of Toledo. Is that the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah. In Buddhist Temple of Toledo, it's there on the website and the Facebook and all those things. And we have a very, very well listened to podcast, the Buddhist Temple of Toledo podcast. Mm-hmm. And that started in 2007. Mm-hmm. So it's been around a really long time. And if you like the way I cuss and talk about the Dharma, you'll get lots of that there on that podcast. Mm-hmm. Great. As well as talks from Doan Sensei and some of the other Shusos and stuff here.
Great. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you for what you're doing, Barry. I enjoyed the conversation.
Could you hang on after we stop? I want to ask you a question.
Sure, man.
Okay, great. Thanks.